This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, The Language of Flowers, botanical folklore in myth and speculative fiction.
So, this week, we're going into territory which I am a little bit murky on.
I think I'm actually confident the minute that I start talking about it, you'll be like, oh, yes, I remember that one too.
Yeah, I think that that probably will be the case. I think memories are going to be jogged. But this is definitely in your ballpark, Jules.
Yeah, and it's a case of, I suppose, it's like, why flowers? The perception being with flowers that, you know, they're pretty and delicate and really not very good for much unless you need to apologise to somebody or, you know, or it's a birthday or something like that. And, you know, categorically, that's obviously not true. For one thing, we don't tend to just go out and pick things from the hedgerow and eat them anymore, or, you know, most people don't, which is a good thing because most of us don't have the sort of country wisdom, shall we say, to identify plants anymore, unless we've deliberately gone out and acquired it. But plants are pretty dangerous, and they have various different connotations as well, depending on how they're being used. And it makes them really interesting. It can certainly add a dimension when you're writing or when you're reading. You might be accessing an entire new level if the author knows what they're talking about. So I think it's worth looking at them. So we're just going to do a little bit of a look through sort of mythology and folklore. But aside from that, obviously a lot of plants have medicinal uses as well. Don't worry, I'm not going to divulge them here.
It could be a whole episode. We should start an aside which is just Jules tells you how.
I think that would be very, very bad.
By the end of it, everyone's a witch. We're all being gathered up and burned at the stake. It's going to be great.
Online initiations.
Okay. This is how cults start.
The thing is, a little bit of knowledge about, you know, what's growing in the hedgerow, what's growing around your house, what sort of plants and things are, can really add to a setting. I don't know anybody who, well, let's take the UK for example, but anybody who has been driving down a road, a rural country road, during the time when the rapeseed's been gathered in, and obviously all these bright, brilliant yellow flowers that absolutely cover the fields and make them a really, really brilliant yellow, and the smell of them when they're being caught, or, you know, bean flowers when they're being harvested. So knowing what something looks like and how it smells and sort of roughly when it flowers can really help with your setting. This year aside, because everything is flowering 6 weeks early and it's giving me serious existential dread.
Is this where it's coming from, Jules? Is it partly, because of the hay fever?
It's partly coming from the fact it's March. We should not have Mayflower out. There's a reason it's called Mayflower. It should be flowering in May, kind of thing going on. But, you know, if you take walks and you notice these things, just saying, you know, that the hedgerow was absolutely brilliant white with blackthorn, anybody who knows anything about sort of living in that sort of climate will be like, oh, well, it's roughly this time of year and it's roughly this sort of area. Even if they don't realise that's what they're knowing, you're scene setting with very few details and very few words wasted even, without anybody having to worry too much about it. So I think things like knowing roughly, you don't have to be a botanical expert, but knowing roughly when things flower and things, and a little bit of herb lore goes a really long way if you write fantasy as well. It's useful to know that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that's my opinion.
It seems like a pretty reasonable and valid opinion to me. But then most of the things that come out of your mouth are...
Do you want to reword that? Oh my god. Sorry. Just filmed me.
What?
I went somewhere bad with that. That was me. That was all me, not you. If I don't cut cut this, then I'm really sincerely sorry to our listeners.
This is one for the blooper reel.
Anyway, part of this is obviously I did, well, not obviously, you might not follow my newsletter. Why don't you follow my newsletter? But I sent out my newsletter recently and I talked a little bit about flowers there, because why not? And I suddenly realised how many people in mythology get turned into bloody flowers.
It is a bit of a running theme. And the weird thing is, it's not just one particular. It sort of actually happens a bit across the board.
It does. A good place to start is ancient Greece, which is usually a reasonable place to start. So I'm going to look at a couple of favourite ones, and then I'll run through some others. But the one that sort of sticks in my mind is the story of Hyacinth and Apollo. Hyacinth was a beautiful youth, and he had many suitors, both male and female, but he chose in the end to be the lover of the god Apollo. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Apollo was, as long as you were beautiful, there was a good chance you'd get in with Apollo.
Good stuff.
Anyway, they spent their day, you know, there's this whole sort of, you could see it as kind of a montage, you know, them feeding each other grapes and riding around in Apollo's swan-drawn chariot and, you know, taking part in sports. And Apollo apparently taught Hyacinth how to do various things like archery, and there was a lot of sex going on as well, to be honest. It gets a bit hazy, yeah. But I'm pretty sure that's what was happening.
Yeah, that definitely seems to be the Greek way.
Anyway, so after the montage, you know, they've had this love affair and they're really, really into each other. And then as boys do, and, you know, girls do too, to be honest, in different ways, they decide to have a discus throwing competition because they want to show off for each other.
Absolutely. It's literally just about having an excuse to flex muscles.
Yeah, pretty much. Anyway, Apollo, being a god and everything, throws his discus with a great deal of power, so powerfully that he rents the clouds asunder. Hyacinth, wanting to show off for his lover, leaps to catch the discus. So immediately I'm put in mind of a Labrador playing Frisbee. And there's two versions of this. Either Zephyr, who was the West Wind and was one of Hyacinth's suitors, and pretty pissed off about being scorned for Apollo, to be honest, blew the discus off course and it struck Hyacinth in the head. Or Hyacinth completely missed the shot, it bounced off the ground, rebounded into his head. Either way, it killed him.
Mm-hmm.
Apollo was distraught. There's lots of artwork of Apollo weeping over the form of Hyacinth. And as Hyacinth's blood fell to the earth, Apollo caused a flower, the Hyacinth flower, to grow from it. Now, that would be the Hyacinth as in Hyacinthus officinalis, which is a cousin of the bluebell. Interesting little bit of aside. Apollo wrote, apparently, on the Hyacinth leaves in Greek, which I can't remember, but he wrote, "Alas, alas, alas, my love is dead," over and over on all the leaves, because that's what you do when you're a god. You're massively dramatic.
Massively dramatic.
All the flowers ever must forever be written, every leaf must be written upon to say that you are mourning your love, who is dead and mortal and now in Hades realm, so you can't access him. And weirdly enough, people kind of believed this right up until the 1800s, when somebody was trying to classify the bluebell, and eventually someone came up with the idea of calling it Hyacinthus nonscripta, because he'd examined the leaves under a microscope and found out that Apollo hadn't actually written anything on this particular form of the hyacinth flower. Which I find really, really funny. It's not really useful bit of lore, but I still find it quite amusing.
That's brilliant.
There you go. That's one. Well, technically it's his blood being turned into flower, but I still like that. Another really good one is the tale of Narcissus and Nemesis.
Yes. Now,
yes, this is a great one. Narcissus, again, was a very, very beautiful man and had many suitors. But unlike Hyacinth, he wasn't choosing amongst them. He thought none of them were good enough for him, and he rejected everybody. And he was quite rude about how he did it as well. He was scornful of them. Nemesis felt that he was causing far too much chaos, and so she caused him to stare at his own reflection when he stopped to rest when hunting one day. It was a very still pool, and Narcissus was spellbound by this stunning creature of beauty he saw gazing up at him from the pool. He fell in love with his own reflection, which suggests that he didn't have brains as well as beauty.
Yep. But then, to be honest, I mean, he might have never seen his own reflection before.
Maybe. So, you're still going to be a special kind of person to look at your own reflection and think, that's not me. But, anyway, so there are two versions of how this ends. Either he looked at his reflection until he wasted away because he was trying to coax his reflection out of the water and this exquisite creature just wouldn't come to him, or he leaned over and tried to kiss his own reflection and drowned himself in the pool.
Good job.
But he was so beautiful, the gods thought, well, you know, he was kind of a dick, but let's memorialize him as a flower. And gold and white flowers burst up. And the daffodil that appears at springtime now is genus Narcissus as well. The Narcissus mm-hmm. itself is a tiny little, like, pygmy daffodil. But basically, daffodil is where we get Narcissus from. We still use the Greek names for all these flowers. That's what I find really interesting.
Yeah.
There are others as well, and they're mostly spring flowers, but I'll be quite quick. There's the story of the youth Crocus, who was crossed in love by the nymph Smilax, and he complained about it, and the gods turned him into a crocus. You've really got to be careful complaining where the gods can hear.
Gods, but, you know, at least they did seem to have a thing about turning people into stuff, and yeah, just like, well, flower him. What? Turn him into a flower?
There is also the snowdrop. Now, the snowdrop, or the galanthus flower, as it was called in Greek, they called it milk drop, basically. One of my favourite flowers didn't start out life as a person, to the best of my knowledge. What's interesting about it was that snowdrop is the best case for being the mysterious herb moly, which was gathered by Odysseus to use it as an antidote against the witch Circe's poisons, by which he managed to get her to agree not to turn his men into pigs, etc., etc., etc. So I sort of like that story. And then what interests me after that is, I'm just checking my notes here. Oh, there was also Clytie, who was a nymph who was in love with the Titan Helios, the sun god, and she was turned into a heliotrope flower. Heliotropes, like sunflowers, obviously they look nothing like sunflowers, but very like sunflowers in that they will turn during the day to face the sun at all, as much as possible. So
yeah.
That's actually quite a nice story if you don't think about the logistics of being a person and then suddenly finding you're a flower.
Yeah, that's. I imagine that a few people would probably be a little bit, you know, upset by that.
There is the story of Asclepius, Asclepius was the god of healing, and he was jealous of his protege Paeony. So Zeus rescued Paeony by turning him into a Paeony.
What a shock that was.
It's like, Zeus, can you not rescue anybody by not turning them into a flower? Can you just, like, teleport them somewhere else?
No. They will live eternity as a flower. That is my wish.
And then there was Orcus. Orcus was the beautiful son of a nymph and a satyr, and when he died, the gods all mourned, so they turned him into an orchid.
See, it's this weird thing between saying, are they then still alive, or did they just create these flowers to mourn them?
It is difficult. One story that sort of gathers things together, or rather the beginning of the story, is before Persephone descended into the underworld, depending on which version you're going for, she was gathering wildflowers. Now, the story where Persephone's gathering wildflowers and Hades emerges in his chariot and carries her off, whether she'd agreed to it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Again, versions vary. But where she's gathering wildflowers, she's actually gathering hyacinth, narcissus, snowdrop, crocus, bindweed, various other things. And I'm like, so basically your fate in ancient Greek myth was to be turned into a flower if you were a beautiful and stupid youth, and then picked by a goddess while she waits for her abductor to turn up. It's also very noticeable that they were all turned into spring flowers as well.
Mm.
So it is a kind of immortality even if it's not, you know, they're the flowers that push themselves up first through the snow, etc. They're the signs of new life every year. And as I said, it's a kind of immortality as far as the gods are concerned. I mean, the gods could have probably just touched you and said, bam, you're immortal now.
They could have, but they've never been simple about that.
But no, the gods are all amateur florists.
They really are. They just seem to think that there was something about flowers which was clearly very, very important. And of course, it's actually kind of fun to look at it from the other perspective, of course, which is that obviously mythos has come from this explanation of you know, where did things come from?
Yeah.
And I just like the fact that people were walking around looking at these beautiful flowers and say, well, clearly this was once a person.
Yes, it's so beautiful. It must have been a person at one point. Last one from the ancient Greek side, at least from me, is the story of Daphne, who is a naiad. Due to some mischief by another god, Apollo just kept chasing after her, determined to get her into bed. Apollo turns up in a lot of these flower stories, actually.
I wonder why.
Daphne wasn't interested in being raped by Apollo.
Weirdly enough.
She prayed to her river god father, who turned her into a laurel tree. Ever after that, Apollo venerated the laurel tree, and on days of triumph, such as the games, the Olympic games, wreaths of laurel were given out to victors.
Huh.
So that's where the whole crowning with laurels thing comes from.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, basically you're picking part of a naiad and turning her into a wreath and then putting her on your head.
The Greeks were wild.
They were wild. It was pretty messed up. So, yeah, it is a running theme, and I do find that quite interesting. I mean, there are obviously Greek stories of people getting turned into various different things, but we're looking specifically at flowers and, by extension, trees and other plants.
Yeah.
And it's not just Greek myth, as Madeline said. There's been various other instances of people being turned into flowers or influenced by flowers or bound to flowers or whatever throughout all mythology. Do you want to weigh in with any, or shall I talk about the Tingedo of Arianrhod?
Yes, let's go to the Mabinogian.
Okay. Little bit, this is a slightly longer tale because it's so messed up, I feel I just have to tell you most of it. I will edit where appropriate, but you know, this is literally
I think if you were going to sort of really inform anyone about anything, the Mabinogian's probably the one that people know less.
Okay, so obviously this is from the Tingedo of Arianrhod, which is part of the Mabinogian. And
Mabinogian, Mabinogian. Sorry, I was saying that wrong.
This was not a problem. I did live in Wales for 4 years, so I feel I have to pronounce it correctly. Anyway, the Welsh hero, Clewclaw Griffiths.
Say that fast 10 times. Yeah.
He was the son of Arianrhod. Arianrhod was determined that her son should never be a hero, and she cast 3 curses on him. One of them was that he should never have a real name. This was significant in Welsh and Celtic mythology, because if your mother would not name you, you were not a person. The story of how he gets his name is completely different, and to be honest, at that point I think I would have been kind of like, I think I should have got a different name. The story of Blodaveth is the second part of the curse, whereby Arianrhod has said that Clewclaw Griffiths shall never have a human wife.
Yes.
Yes. Now, that sounds, you know, pretty bad, really. Up until that point, you know, it's kind of like, no love for you, Clue. Forget that.
That or bestiality. I do like the fact they're like, you shall never have a human wife. Fine, I'll get a fairy then.
So what happens is the magicians Marth and Gwydion came in and said, oh, we can sort this out for you. And they took the flowers of oak, the flowers of broom, and the flowers of meadowsweet, and fashioned for him a woman. And she was the most beautiful woman. The name Blodaveth actually means flower face in Welsh.
Yeah.
The trouble is, nobody asked Blodaveth what she wanted. She was made, you know, one minute she was a bunch of flowers, the next minute she was a woman, and she was like, here's your husband, bam. He's a great Welsh hero. And she's kind of like, nobody's actually asked me this.
Yeah. Look, I was just in the fields and now I'm not, and this is very confusing and very fast.
So when Clu was away one day, Blodaveth took up with a local lord of Penclen called Gronwa Pabe. And, you know, she took him as a lover. And they decided that they were going to murder her husband.
Which as was, you do.
Which was no easy thing, because Clu was rather like Cahalan from Irish folklore.
Yeah.
You know, he was sort of blessed of the old ones. He was quite difficult to kill. So playing Delilah, Blodaveth gets Clu to admit how he may be killed. And this is, I've kind of got to read this. Apparently he could only be killed at dusk, whilst wrapped in a net, with one foot on a bath and one on a black goat, by a riverbank, using a spear forged for a year during the hours of prayer.
Yeah, and it's literally because he couldn't be killed during day or night, whilst standing on land or at sea, by any, what was it, sort of weapon forged legally or something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, they basically had to kind of find all of the most dramatic loopholes whereby he wasn't on the earth, he was on top of a goat and half in a bath. He couldn't be killed indoors or outdoors either, so we had to be like between a doorway and at dusk, because we couldn't be killed during the day or night.
Yeah, so having found this out, Blodaveth goes back to Gronn, and somehow they contrive for this to happen. Now, personally, if I'd been a Clu, I'd have been kind of like, you want me to stand on a goat in a bath? Hang on a minute, this rings a bell.
Hold on a second. Also, I mean, personally, in general, if someone said, hi, I want you to stand on a goat in a bath. Right. why? Just do it. I'd be a little bit, I'd have questions.
I would have significant questions as well. Anyway, Gronwa manages to get hold of such a spear, and Blodaveth gets Clu into the right position, and Gronwa throws the spear and wounds Clu, but he only wounds him, he doesn't kill him, and Clu turns into an eagle, as you do. At this point, Gwydion, the magician, comes back in, and by singing a particular song, he brings Clu back, and then he catches up with Blodaveth, and to punish her, he turns her into an owl, and forevermore, her name shall be the name of mourning, and she will cry her regret and her sorry for her betrayal. So basically, Blodaveth became synonymous with the sound an owl makes. Honestly, I don't think Blodaveth is actually what a barn owl sounds like, personally.
Nope.
But there we go from there. Meanwhile, just to finish the story off, Gronwa gets in touch with Clu and begs his forgiveness. And Clu is like, I don't forgive you. I'm not going to forgive you. And you stand on a riverbank and let me throw a spear at you. And Gronn was kind of like, yes, but you're kind of the son of a goddess, and I'm an ordinary man. If you must do this, then let me put a stone between us. So Clu said that's fine, and puts a great big boulder between himself and Gronn. He's got one cast of the spear, and because he's the son of a goddess, he throws the spear straight through the stone, and it hits Gronn and kills him. And the stone still exists, apparently. It's a stone, a large boulder with a hole right through the middle, and is called, unsurprisingly, the Stone of Gronn.
Hmm.
So there you go. That's an interesting surface look at the story of Blodaveth. And, you know, obviously part of the story is that, as we've said before from other myths and things, anything created, once it's free and sentient, belongs always and only to itself. So he could give Clu a woman made of flowers for a wife, but she didn't belong to him. She still belonged to herself, and she would make her own choices and be punished for them. And presumably, part of the reason Gwydion turned her into an owl was the fact that she was too dangerous to be allowed to roam free.
One thing I'd be interested to find out, and I don't know whether there would be anything to this, would be to explore the properties which are then given to certain flowers. You know, we have the secret language of flowers, you know, these flower languages, but properties and mythos and emotions and messages which are attributed to certain flowers, and to see whether there is actually any connection between the way that they've been used in mythos and how much of that has, you know, how much those two things are intertied.
Yeah, and actually, you're really onto something there. Obviously, it was the flowers of oak, the flowers of broom, and the flowers of meadowsweet.
Mm.
Oak is for kingship, or for royalty, or queenship, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Broom is... It has several meanings, but broom is for banishing the fair folk.
Ooh!
there's a reason a witch's broom was called a broom. It used to be made out of broom, strangely enough.
What a shock. You brought them up before I did, so actually that's a lie, I brought them up earlier. Oh, I did.
Quid in the F jar. well, a quid is still worth something. And then there's meadow sweet.
Weird time to get political, but okay, continue.
Well, we're talking about kind of the ultimate political marriage in history.
This is true.
Yeah, meadowsweet. Meadowsweet's an interesting one. On one hand, it means innocence and purity, but on the other, meadowsweet's bortifacient and was used by herb wives to provoke a miscarriage for an unwanted child.
Yeah,
it has sexist names like lad's love, because it would actually start your courses going again if you missed them for any reason.
It's also incredibly poisonous. I do like meadowsweet because it's like, in France in particular, you gather meadowsweet and you give it during certain parts of the year, and it's all very, you know, la 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 la, very lovely, meadowsweet, innocence, children, mothers. And as you say, it's actually quite poisonous, and it was used to abort fetuses.
Yeah, if you happen to have a bad reaction to something like meadowsweet, it wasn't just the fetus that went either.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of affection for that particular story. I'm not sure why, because I don't think anybody ends up happily in it. But then with most of the Celtic myths, that's the case.
Yeah, happily ever after is not something most people are really worried about.
But I think it's... One of the things it does underline is the fact that even at its most seemingly innocent and sweet and beautiful, nature is dangerous.
Mm.
Nature is really dangerous and needs to be respected. And you can make something out of flowers, but you are making a predator, and it's worth remembering that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a good version, and maybe you'd like to take this one, a good example, which we have talked about before, mm-hmm. is the story of Balder.
Yes. So, right. So, for those who don't know about Balder, Balder is from Norse mythology, and he was the beloved son of not Freya, but what's her name?
It was Frigga, wasn't it?
Frigga. Yes. The beloved son of Frigga. And the little brother of Thor. And he was known as Balder the Beautiful, and everybody loved Balder. he was just too good to be true, in every essence of the word. Beautiful, very talented, a mighty warrior. Frigga started to get worried about something bad happening to Balder, as you do. And so she basically conspired with all of the elements of the world and kind of pushed them into forming this agreement that they would never hurt Balder. So she did it with metal, she did it with spears, she did it with snakes, she did it with, you know, rivers, so that he became virtually 100% indestructible. Nothing could actually hurt him. He was so beloved that everything kind of agreed to that. Except Frigga missed out one very crucial thing. And in some versions it's because she overlooked it. In other versions it was because it was considered to be too young to form that kind of agreement and too weak to really be to be, you know, considered a threat. And that was the mistletoe. Mistletoe was kind of thrown out because it thought, oh God, okay, what's mistletoe going to do though? So really, we can probably just not worry about that. Unfortunately, and of course it depends who, but Loki. let's give him credit where it's due course. Loki went, not sure about this. And Loki created a dart or an arrowhead in some versions made of mistletoe. And what was happening was that all of the gods, they were out there, they're having a good time, and they had this game where they would just throw things at Boulder. It's great because this is just so typical. It's just like, oh, so you can't be killed. Let's test that. They would throw shit at him, spears and stuff, and they'd all have a great laugh as everything just sort of bounced off. And there was a Hoder, who was another one of Odin's sons, was born blind. And of course, depending on the myth, but for the most part, Loki basically put this deadly dart into Hoder's hands and said, throw, and sort of guided his arm. Hoder threw and killed Balder instantly. It pierced Balder's lung, and Balder died. And since then, there has been a very, very, there's been a weird relationship between of mistletoe and how it's used and what it represents. And I think there's several kind of things that come onto it, because once again, this is a very, very small, weak kind of sapling plant which is overlooked.
Yes,
it's actually incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, it's parasitical. It doesn't grow on the ground. It grows in the branches of oak, apple, beech, and, you know, deciduous trees, basically.
Yeah.
So a berry or a seed falls into a crack in a tree, and it grows from there. And you can certainly see it at this time of year before the coniferous trees have really got their green mantle over them, hanging in the branches.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it's incredibly poisonous and was also used as an abortifacient.
Once again.
Which I find ironic, because you have Frigga, who was going around making deals with every living thing, saying, oh, don't hurt my son, etc., etc., didn't with the mistletoe, and then the mistletoe was actually an abortifacient and took her son away.
Yes. Which is a nice kind of little aside.
Yep.
Weirdly enough, now, of course, where do we see mistletoe used in common tradition now?
Obviously with Christmas festivities as a sign of love and affection and fertility, because it will grow anywhere.
Yes.
It will grow only in the branches, but I think the idea sort of comes from the Druidic tradition of it being neither a fire nor water nor earth nor air, but combining all the elements, and they, you know, wouldn't even call it by its real name because it was too powerful, and it was used in various different druidic rituals.
Yes. It is funny. I find it hard to sort of basically I don't think it can be summarized in any way. But there is this relationship of mistletoe being representative of love as well.
Yeah.
And it's peculiar because it has such a diverse nature in that way. And once again, it's strange that we see these plants which are typically associated, which were practically used to induce miscarriage.
Yeah.
Also being used symbolically to represent fertility, being used to represent love, being used to in practice. And yet again, in mythos, their significance in mythos is tied to something dramatic and deadly.
Yeah, definitely. It is quite interesting. If you look at something like Culpepper's Complete Herbal, when he talks about poisonous plants, he also talks about the antidote being either a very similar plant or found within a different preparation of the plant. And I won't go too much into to herbal medicine and traditional folk remedies, but there is a body of law with genuine, you know, with some genuine evidence behind it that one poison hates another. So yeah. Please do not try this at home, folks. But this is something that I know from years and years of researching this stuff, not testing it on anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Something like monkshood poisoning could theoretically be halted and, you know, reversed by a different type of poison. And I'm not actually, I think I'm just not going to say because it's making me nervous.
No, go on.
Okay, but, you could use something like deadly nightshade.
Yes.
And obviously it's different preparations and it's how you do it, because if you take if you just take something like peppermint, you can make an infusion, or you can make a decoction, or you can turn it into an ointment. And every single thing you do to a particular herb means that you will get one of its attributes slightly differently from it.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting, and it just shows how versatile plants are and how careful you need to be with them.
Yeah. Again, don't try this at home.
Definitely don't try this at home. I mean, one of the first things you hear, or a similarity to this, one of the first things I heard when I started learning about herbal medicine was the time that a couple decided to dose themselves with comfrey leaves, having had a cold, and they weren't sure of their plant identification. Instead, they dosed themselves with foxglove, which has similar hairy leaves. And they both had massive heart attacks and died.
Because,
you know, foxglove contains digitalin, which, you know, stimulates your involuntary muscle in places like your gut, your heart, and your eyes. It's not to be played around with.
Yeah, don't recommend, really, to be honest.
Moving on from herbal medicine, which I think that might be safer, let's talk briefly about trees. Trees in general, because there is a huge body of law and tradition about trees and what trees mean. For example, if you were to hand someone a willow twig in Wales, I'm back to Wales again, you're rejecting a lover, you're rejecting a suitor. That was a way of doing it politely, hand them a willow twig.
Aww.
And obviously the druidic tradition, things like yew, oak, hazel, rowan, all have their own significance as well. Yew was the tree of death. Incidentally, it was also the tree that, you know, the best bows were made out of. Oak was the king of the wood. Holly was the king of winter. Hazel for wisdom, but hazel also for virility.
It's this nice combination of different properties again, isn't it?
It is.
Contrasting and yet still tied.
I mean, we won't go through every single tree, but I think it's worth, since we're going to sort of have a quick look at plants in folk songs in a minute, looking at the fact that of the druidic tradition of the 12 holy trees, nearly all of them are deciduous, and a lot of that is to do with the fact that, you know, when the druidic tradition was sort of developed, if you like, most of the forests in Britain would have been coniferous forests with, you know, just some evergreen type stuff.
Mm.
A lot of the evergreen that's here now has been, you know, brought in from other countries.
Yeah.
So there is that. But obviously evergreen in sort of various folk traditions now has its place as well as a signifier of eternal life, and we hang up wreaths of evergreen on our doors at Christmas with holly and things to show that there's green in the depths of winter, and it's a kind of sympathetic magic to encourage the sun to come back. But it's really, in fact, I can't say off the top of my head because I don't know how many, but many, many, many folk songs and many folk stories have the greenwood in them, and they're talking about the old coniferous forests of the UK and Europe.
Yeah, which we actually have touched on
yeah.
in the past episode.
We have. The greenwood was where you met your lover. The greenwood was where you might meet your doom. The greenwood was also where you might die and be buried and hidden the Greenwood kept secrets and revealed them. And it's just really interesting how that's remembered in folk song as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. In folk song too, and a lot of this has to be attributed to Celtic mythology. In particular, you know, we're talking about British folk songs from the United Kingdom. I think the most common kind of trees that you'll hear about when it's Celtic are oak, apple, and ash. Hang on. Oak and ash and thorn. Those are the three.
I can't say I've noticed that so much, but I've definitely noticed willow.
Willow is true. Willow trees. Oak is almost always there. It's got its foundations and some quite important stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the English oak is very much that's a stereotype of its own now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
willow trees turn up in forlorn songs about love. Basically, in folk songs, the willow tree means that you have either your lover has either died or you've been crossed in love and they've abandoned you. Mm. For example, All Around My Hat. That song is great. It's got a really chirpy song. But it's All Around My Hat, I Will Wear the Green Willow. And that's a case of, I'm hanging on to my lover for a year and a day, even though they've left me.
Aww.
Which is, you know. And there was even the expression to wear the willow. To wear the willow for somebody was to hope that they would come back to you. Or you were in mourning because they died. A little bit of folk tradition. I'm going to mention Let No Man Steal Your Time. So we're back to herbs. But the time I'm talking about is not time as in a unit of measurement of years and days. I'm talking about the
herb
time.
That is a great title, Let No Man Steal Your Time.
Yeah, that's a bit sci-fi. That's a sci-fi version of this. Let No Man Steal Your Time. Time represents, time the herb rather, represents in folklore virtue. So Let No Man Steal Your Time was actually a cautionary song for young maidens not to give away their virginity. Mm. And if you look at, I kind of like the song, even though it's horribly sexist. It's quite poetic, but it's let no man steal your time. And then you get onto the second verse. The first verse talks about keeping your garden fair. Guess what that's about?
Mm.
You get onto the second verse and it's like, for when your time is past and gone. So when you've given your virtue away, the path will be spread all over with rue. Rue is a pretty little yellow flower, but rue was for regret. But rue was also an abortifacient, interestingly enough. So it's this whole thing with sex and unwanted pregnancy, with a little clue in the song about how you might do something about that.
Yeah.
And then later in the song, someone else, you have the gardener's boy was standing by. He's offering a red rose from a red rose tree. Red roses were very sexual.
Mm.
So it's a case of, yeah, someone's come along and they're offering you this. But the person in the song is saying, I've gained the willow tree. And it's like, I've been left behind again.
Aww.
I've been crossed in love, they've left me, in this instance, it's genuinely a case of, I've given away my virtue, I'm probably pregnant, and they've abandoned me. That is literally what the song is about.
It's always, I'm probably pregnant, and they're gone. Another common theme in,
yeah.
It's the flowers and birds, those. Flowers and birds, we could have a whole episode just on that. You know, it's just, sorry, I'm just thinking about earlier mythology getting turned into an owl. There seems to be an intrinsic relationship between those two elements as well.
A whole returning to nature thing.
Yeah.
We've talked about Scarborough Fair before.
We have.
I think it's actually worth revisiting because of the herbs.
Yeah, so Scarborough Fair. The meaning of the herbs in Scarborough Fair, and again, we have discussed this, so sorry if we're sort of treading over old ground. there's lots of different ways that it can be interpreted. Definitely my favourite, because I'm a morose little so-and-so, is the idea that that the message behind Scarborough Fair is about death.
Yeah.
And the impossibility of two lovers being together if one is dead, and only if impossible tasks can be achieved can a dead person and a living person be together again.
Yeah, definitely. And it's there with the herbs, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Thyme, once again, is a virtue, but it can also mean a chaste love or a love that was not consummated. Rosemary is for remembrance, so to remember somebody who is past and gone. Sage is usually wisdom and balance, strangely enough. Mm. And parsley was always known as the herb of death. You weren't supposed to bring it into the house. It wasn't usually added to salads and things. It was used to put in water to wash dead bodies with. It was also the herb for if you'd been crossed in love. So, yeah, on one hand, Madeline's right. This could be two lovers divided by death, or it could be the ultimate I'm not taking you back song.
Yeah.
When you can walk up the pyramids of Egypt on your hands, then I might consider it. Otherwise, screw you. And obviously, as the verses go on, the narrator of the song is saying, once you can do all these things, then, I'll consider being with you again, or we can be together again, depending on whether you're going for death or crossed in love. Death and being crossed in love are very closely linked in folk songs. Have you noticed that?
Yes, I wonder why that might be. I think love and death have a very strong relationship, regardless, both in mythos and in truth. But yeah, so you've got parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. I'm trying to think of another example of herbs being used similarly in songs, and how actually, weirdly enough, the use of these herbs or the use of certain flowers will change the meaning or will actually give the meaning. So you mentioned before willow trees used in songs almost always means that there has been a death of some kind, or the loss of some kind, and oak trees tend to kind of give this sense of pride and strength and kingliness, sorry, I'm not using my words right, but pride, I think, is probably one of the strength. Yeah,
I mean, there's the whole bury me beneath the willow, the weeping willow tree. Yeah, in this case of I've died for love.
Yeah,
which is like that. Okay, dramatic.
Yeah,
folk songs tend to be quite dramatic.
I mean, to be honest, then you can't accuse them of being boring. That's for sure.
I mean, when
slightest inconvenience and death.
Yeah. See, thyme comes up a lot as well because it's in Rainodyne as well. So it's as I walked out one evening amongst the spreading thyme. So when I was out, I happened to see a young maid conversing with Rainodyne. Rainodyne is a shape-shifting fox who turns into a human to seduce beautiful young maidens.
Of course.
And of course, you're walking through the thyme. It's like you're walking through the virtue and that's it. That's it. It's gone. You know that she's... I mean, the narrator of the song isn't going to interrupt.
No.
This woman gets seduced.
And then, there are also, some other very poignant ones which stand out. So roses, red roses, are intrinsically linked with love and passion.
And sex.
And sex, as you say. Daisies have a kind of innocence to them.
The lily as well. Roses and lilies seem to go together as well. I mean, if you think about... did you not see my lady? They use obviously the sunshine, but the rose and the lily and the bird song for you.
And the bird song, and of course, but it's nice because the rose is, lily is also sadness as well, because white lilies are what one puts on a grave.
Yeah.
And of course, did you not see my lady? It's about what's it called when someone doesn't love you back?
Unrequited
love. So there is both the happiness and the sadness as well that comes with it. And flowers, I think they've continued to be used in this way, but it's interesting because with them, with the addition of them, you can add so many new dimensions to what you are writing.
Yeah.
New meanings, new directions. And I also wonder actually how much then within, because obviously you've got some, these very famous examples that we've looked at, how much of that actually can you just use on its own by simply talking about the willow? You don't actually have to mention death at all without it being plain.
No, I don't think you do. I mean, I'm thinking about, okay, there's instances in classic literature when I think the sort of foliage and plants and things that are put around, particularly in Gothic fiction, kind of give you a clue as to the mood. So, I mean, if you think of Jane Eyre and the bare thorn trees that contain a rookery outside Thornfield Hall and things like that.
Yeah. There's an aesthetic thing as well. I think the other thing that you have to remember is that with the introduction of plants, you actually also bring in season.
Yep, definitely.
And there's a very strong, you know, that these are strongly interlinked. So things like holly, it's winter, okay? Things like roses, it's sort of spring or early summer. You know, same with daffodils too. You snowdrops. You get these very, very particular kind of seasons. And so it's not just the flowers. It's this whole atmosphere it brings with it. Because again, particular flowers are associated with particular seasons, particular times of year. You can actually get holly pretty much. Holly's around for most of the year.
It's worth actually just mentioning the actual Victorian language of flowers.
Yes.
Which obviously I don't know completely off the top of my head because it contains hundreds and hundreds of flowers. I'd like some sort of compendium actually because that would just be really, really neat to look at. But just as an example, the sort of rose you give somebody, if you're doing it and how you give it, if I was, let's say for example, that I decided to give Madeline a red rose. If I gave it to Madeline with my right hand, I would be making her an offer of a, you know, love and passionate sexual nature. If Madeline took it with her right hand, she'd be accepting. If she took it with her left hand, she'd be saying, no, thank you very much.
But I want the rose.
But I want the rose. I'll accept your gift. Mere puny human. Not good enough for me. And then it's the type of rose as well. If I handed her a white rose from my left hand, I would be offering her innocent love. And how she accepted it with right or left hand would depend on sort of like how she would like, what direction she would like that to go in. If it was a yellow rose, I'd either be saying, this is friendship, or I'd be saying, you cheated on me, you bitch. So it really depends. And there's so many nuances and things. Obviously, there's the herbs we've talked about. Some of them are quite famous, and things like willow twigs. And I mean, I think if you randomly handed somebody a willow twig now, they'd be like, what? Because we've kind of lost that. But it's like, why aren't you giving me an actual bunch of flowers? Why is it a willow twig?
I also do like the idea of being really bitter with someone, but you can't sort of express it. So being passive aggressive and telling them to go fuck themselves with flowers. That idea really amuses me.
Just, you know, give me a bunch of yellow roses and parsley.
This is for you. Go fuck yourself. No, I actually, weirdly enough, I'm for our school dance. I got asked out. I went with a friend of mine who was in, who is still, I say was, he hasn't stopped. Is incredibly gay. As in, I think already quite open at the school, and he bought me a total gentleman as well, and a fantastic dancer, which is more than can be said for me. But he took me to two dances, and every time he bought me a bouquet of white flowers.
Aww.
And everyone else got red flowers, but I saw the white flowers, and I knew where he was going for with this. It was just, they're like, I like you very much, but we're both on the same spot.
That's kind of a nice way of doing it, though, if you trust the other person to sort of have a bit of nounce and understand what they're talking about.
Yeah. No, it was very, very nice.
And herbs and flowers are deliberately used in this way in some modern speculative fiction as well. I'm partly thinking of me because I'm a nerd, but also I'm not the only nerd because I'm talking about Samantha Shannon's Bone Season, where she literally uses the language of flowers for her gangsters to communicate with each other.
Yeah.
Which is very, very cool.
That is actually a very, very cool idea. I do love the language of flowers and the language of trees, because in Celtic mythology, each tree has obviously got its own meaning as well. And when I rewrote a version of Scarborough Fair called Elder Oak, Ash, Apple and Thorn, all about Fionn Mac Cumhail and his fight with the Lochlannach, and the trees were literally chosen to represent a different aspect of to tell the story, but through trees. So elder and oak, being wise, and I've forgotten all of the meanings, so I'm probably going to get this wrong, but wisdom and strength, ash, apple, thorn, protection, regret as well, and learning. As I said, they're all in there. I've mixed them all up, and I've probably skewered that explanation a little bit. But at the time, it was thoroughly researched, and they were used for that purpose exactly. And I was very pleased with myself.
Yeah. So I mean, obviously, this is a slightly lighter episode than some previous ones, but it is, I think, important to think about your flora. When you're world building, when you're writing, and sometimes think about it when you're reading someone else's writing. Have they absolutely deliberately gone for something? Have they perhaps done it subconsciously, or have they not thought about it at all? Are they telling you it's October and they've got roses blooming, without explaining that they're magical roses that always bloom in the autumn or whatever?
And actually, you may just uncover some deep undercover depth.
Yeah. To be honest, if you using myself as an example, if I've put a flower or a plant or something in there, it's kind of there for a reason.
Yeah.
And that reason might only mean something to me, but it definitely means something.
So there you go, guys, something to think about.
Yes.
And I think we've run out of time.
Yes, we have.
But before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation, and Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
I have. I'm not going to... completely moving away from flowers and plants now. The Gilded Walls by Roshani Chokshi, which is something that if you have read Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom and are desperate for something to fill the gap, that might well suit you. It's set in an... 19th century steampunk Paris, and features alchemists and dark magic and a quest for a magical item. So think sort of Indiana Jones, Lara Croft, but way cooler, set in a steampunk Paris. And it has a great diverse cast. There's an autistic Jewish character who is absolutely awesome. She's lovely. There's plenty of queer characters, one of whom in particular I think Madeline just finds hilarious. and it's really good fun. I wouldn't say I loved the main character, and I am a little bit sick of people saying, oh, well, this character's just like Kaz Brekker, when in fact Kaz Brekker was drawn from a body of tropes just like every other sort of diamond in the rough gangster character ever was. It's not like that at all, and it's just a really, really good entertaining book, so I would give that a go.
Well, thanks very much. I'm definitely going to add that to my list. You know how I feel about Six of Crows.
It is a duology, so the next book is out hopefully next year.
Fantastic. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.